now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Rockers, and welcome to this week's episode of the podcast. I'm relieved that Mark Evans isn't in, because I've had a bit of a crisis over saying hello, Rutgers. I was saying it, and then a few weeks ago, he was on the seat where Steve Jones is currently and started laughing his head off to the point we had to re-record. And now I feel I'm a kind of a Butlin's red coat saying it, like, hello, Rutgers. Anyway, unless anyone here objects, I'm going to persist.
Persist, please. And persist. I'm glad Mark Evans is not here, because the rest of us can
honestly
get a word in now.
I couldn't. We had to re-record the intro because he was spluttering into the mic. Anyway, hello, Rutgers. Welcome to this week's episode of your favourite rugby podcast from the Times, the Sunday Times. It's a momentous day for us. Stephen Jones is in the studio, rugby correspondent for the Sunday Times, and we have a debut appearance from Will Kelleher, the new deputy rugby correspondent for the Times.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. How's it going?
Well, we're good. How are you feeling?
Yeah, it feels like I've been at the Times for longer than the week. I've been doing plenty of stuff. Euro wranglings that sorted themselves out,
yeah.
A match. So, yeah, this is my first ruck. How exciting.
Yeah. Now, well, plenty to come, Will. We'll keep you on your toes.
Welcome, Will.
Steve, how was your weekend?
Excellent. I had a really nice day in Coventry, where we all sat there, being the old cynics, saying, well, they did that to Leicester. There's no way they're going to do that to Toulouse. And after 5 minutes, Toulouse has scored a frighteningly easy try. So that was that. We're never going to hear from Wasps again, except we did hear one or two things from them. And even the cross-country train was on time. So that was the sort of great weekend it was. It was great.
We'll explore that game in a lot of depth coming up with Ed Robinson, the Wasps skills coach, who's going to join us on the pod. Will, where were you this weekend?
I was at Northampton, Franklin's Gardens, or Cinch at Franklin's Gardens, to give it its proper name, on Sunday. And yeah,
please
it was Courtney Law's 250th game, but they kind of let him down a bit, and he went off exhausted. Apparently he had COVID before Christmas, so he's trying to get back into it and just ran out of gas.
Yeah,
really.
But he'd given everything. I was at West Ham on Sunday watching West Ham lose to Leeds. Declan Rice was like a one-man performance in the second half, couldn't have given any more. And it reminded me of Courtney's performance for Northampton. Everything around him wasn't really working, but he strained every sinew and eventually just burned himself out after just over an hour. But
yeah,
extraordinary again from him.
Yeah, no, he was epic. And actually, as you guys are aware, there was a sort of the worried look when he's got both arms on his head and going off, and you think, oh, England scored out on Tuesday. But Phil Dowson told us afterwards that he was just knackered and told us that was it.
It was a sort of a European weekend from the sublime to the ridiculous, really. We had some extraordinary games that we thought would had brought a competition back to life, that on this pod in particular we've criticised the format and how people take it seriously. And then we had the ridiculous Leinster-Montpellier game, which I'm sure we'll talk about. We'll cast our minds ahead to Eddie Jones naming his squad for the Six Nations. But before we get there, Steve, you've been looking at the World Cup playoffs.
Yeah, fascinating.
Chile have got USA this year.
Yeah.
How do you see that?
Thing is, I just thought we'd mention it because Chile are we all need a brand new team in the competition, someone who's not been there before, someone who can prove that the game is spreading. And Chile have been fantastic. They beat the USA, if you remember. Los Condores beat the USA. They got some great. I just talk about the forwards. They've got some great forwards there: Diego Escobar, Luis Alvarado, Raimundo Martinez, a great flanker. These guys, Alfonso Escobar, these guys are all in their 20s,
yeah.
which is bloody good. So these are the forwards. I don't know if anyone knows the backs.
Will,
but these are some of the great Chilean forwards.
Any thoughts on the backs, Will?
I've sensed the stitch up here. Timestamp on the stitch up. What were we, 11:05 on Monday morning?
What do you mean? This is a serious rugby pod. This is Chile, one of the important teams of
the world. I think they're going to be fantastic.
One of the great stories of the year.
Which players in the backs, though, do you think will be guiding them?
In the backs? So yeah. I think that, well, the fly half and scrum half, that's usually where the meat of it is.
Yeah. You don't know the names or anything.
No, I don't know.
Okay, fair enough.
Welcome,
Will Kelleher, to the Ruck. Coming up, we'll go through all the key European action from the weekend. We'll chat to Ed Robinson from Wasps, examine who should or might be in Eddie Jones' England Six Nations squad. And Jess Hayden will be back with her regular update on the weekend's action in the Allianz Premier 15s. So I mentioned Europe was a case of the sublime to the ridiculous. We had some fantastic games, really tight wins this weekend. Wasps, obviously, against Toulouse, which we'll discuss. Harlequins edged it at Cardiff, 36-33. Exeter were involved in a real battle for an hour or so against Glasgow before pulling clear. And obviously Leicester left it to the very last play of the game to win out in Connaught, which is exactly what you want, isn't it, guys? From
yes.
European games, tight down to the whistle, one play in it, all that kind of thing.
They were all on as well. All the games all took place, which was great because it looked like there was a time when it wasn't. But it's funny because you're still trying to catch up with the way the competition is meant to pan out. I mean, I spent about an hour last night looking at the laws, looking at the bylaws for qualification.
It is a problem because you never know what one game means for anyone else.
No, you don't. You don't.
And
we won't do till the weekend.
Yeah.
Till they're all done. But look, there was some great rugby, some real, in my opinion, devaluation of the tournament by certain teams. But there was some great rugby. I saw the epic Wasps Toulouse game. Cardiff Quins was excellent as well for many reasons. And really nice to see Exeter play well and also Bristol. Coming through, if you're an English fan, not so good. Welsh clubs, again, Cardiff apart, very, very weak.
This time last week, we were talking about English clubs potentially boycotting their trips to France, and luckily that didn't happen. I think the European Cups needed a good weekend and probably got one.
Yeah.
And next weekend's going to be fascinating because there's going to be a hell of a lot of moving and shaking to find out who's going to be in those last 16 games. And they could be some epic ties. You could get some... Leinster Munster could be one of them and things like that. So I think it needed a big weekend and got one with some of these quite interesting games.
Yeah, we will ask you about Quins in a sec, Will, given that you live on their doorstep. But the that whole structure, Steve, of Europe, I know it's COVID's had its impact and they've lost weekends. But if you've got teams that don't care about it, then do they deserve to be in it? I mean, do we need... No club, no competition is going to want to make things smaller and have fewer games because of the financial impact.
Yes.
And yet we're in that position where having an enormous competition now is undermining itself because you've got teams that don't seem to care.
It's very difficult. And no one has yet reached the depths of Agen, who, if you remember, years ago, played Pontypridd in, the second-ranked match, and actually were giggling all the way through and letting people run through. I think they were banned from the tournament. It wasn't quite as bad as that. But when you get a team, a proud team like Montpellier, with Philippe Saint-André, who won the league with Sale, just not making any attempt to compete at all. That suggests that, all right, you can always say we just took a weak team to rest people, but when you've got Leinster, surely that has got to stir the blood and you go over there and try and beat them. But the Montpellier were awful against Leinster. Leinster are very short to match practice. I still don't think they've had any. Mm. I mean, they didn't get match practice from that game. So that was poor. I thought that Leicester, mighty Leicester, if they are serious at all, Alex, why on earth would you chuck out a load of players and not take them? And they were one play away from struggling themselves. So I just don't get it. I mean, these days with the salary cap going down and COVID, it is difficult to cover all competitions, but blimey, surely Montpellier, Cardiff, and also I think I know we'll come to this later because Will was there, but Northampton, for me, there is something seriously wrong there, and I think Mr. Boyd's term had to end even if he wanted to stay, because he is not firing that team up.
Just on the Montpellier one, it looked like an Ashes scoreline, didn't it? 89-7. Yeah. Felt like Mark Wood was going to come wandering out, trying to go for a hooray, Henry. At the end.
Yeah, yeah, quite. And I, you know, Leinster, like you say, see, they've been short of match practice. They attacked that game to me like, you know, like an aggrieved party, because their game in Montpellier was off.
Yes,
and they claimed that they had government approval to send a team out. EPCR called it off, gave them a 28-0 defeat.
Yeah.
And it felt like they had to go and not only make up those 28 points, but then some, and did it with ease. It was really poor for the competition. Northampton lost to a weakened Ulster team, and we've talked about Courtney and what a titan he is for them and for England, and Eddie Jones will be desperate that he gets back to full whack for the Six Nations. But yeah, the news sort of confirmed since our last pod that Chris Boyd will leave in the summer, that Phil Dowson will take over as director of rugby, and Sam Vesti will get a head coach's role. They were those two actually running the show on the weekend, because Chris Boyd was banned for two games for comments about the referee after the Saracens game, claiming he didn't have the nuts to penalise Saracens on their own line.
Mm.
Will, what did you make of it when you were there?
It was very strange, because Chris Boyd was allowed to attend the game. So he was there. He was sitting up on the Barwell stand.
Yeah, just banned from coaching.
Yeah, so he wasn't allowed to be involved on the match day, but apparently he'd prepare the team during the week and will do this week when they're going to Racing 92 in Paris next weekend, which could be a bit of a dangerous afternoon for them.
That's not that's not where you want to go if you're
in the big cinema in Paris, yeah. So yeah, it was strange. It was, as I wrote in the Times today in the match report, it was a sort of glimpse of the future with Dowson and Vesti in charge, but same old problems. I mean, that was, I do like a stat, and that was their sixth European Champions Cup defeat in a row, which is a record for the club. The last time they won a game in Europe, if you guys remember, was when they got to the quarterfinals after the postponed lockdown period and played Exeter when Manny Yogan had to play loosehead prop down at Sandy Park in front of no fans. And they got beaten easily in that game. And since, they've lost every single pool game. So
they're back in that cycle that they were in previously, where I remember Stuart Barnes wrote a column on it, where they'd strive all year to qualify for the Champions Cup, and then they'd get there, and it was like, what's the point? You know, they weren't competitive in it.
I don't feel like clubs do this on purpose, but for years I've had a real problem with Premiership teams, and I know we were talking about Montpellier first, but I think the English clubs have a lot to answer for too in years gone by, and not necessarily this season because Quins have done well, but there's the usual drama about coming in the top eight or previously the top six. Harlequins, Gloucester, Bath, Northampton, all those sides make a big deal about getting in Europe, and then previously in the old format they'd lose one game and then phone it in for the rest of the competition. Quins have certainly done that in years gone by. I remember Paul Gustard resting a whole load of players for an Ulster game at home, which they got beaten easily in. Bath have done it for years. Northampton, whether they've wanted to or not, have, as we said, lost six in a row. So it's a massive problem. And personally, I think the European Cup should be fewer teams.
Mm.
I feel like it should be an elite 16, five from each league, plus the winner of the Challenge Cup from the year before. Keep it tighter, because having a baggy 24-team tournament where seven or eight teams, firstly, don't have a hope, and secondly, when they get there, just get beaten easily. I mean, things like 89-7, there's just no point. I mean, the stat on that one as well was that was the biggest defeat in the Champions Cup for 17 years and the largest margin of victory for 21 years. So that's not good for the tournament, is it?
Just make sure we don't miss one of the threads here, though, because there are teams you must hand it to Munster, Ulster, Leinster, and indeed Connaught. They really give it the tournament something. I mean, look, I think one of the reasons is because these guys can qualify so easily from what used to be the Celtic Cup, now is the URC, that they don't have to bust a gut every year. But you take Munster, went to Castra. Castra, one of the great non-triers, but actually they did try this time. And as usual, Munster found a way to get through. Ulster found a way to get through. Leinster's eased through. These guys know better than anyone what it takes to win in Europe. And anyone, a lot of others could take to take an example from them, Alex.
It's a classic less is more argument, isn't it, Will, that we've had on this pod about all rugby, that you can have loads and loads of European games, but if they start to not mean enough, or teams can't invest in them because they're too worried about domestic stuff, then those games themselves lose their value.
Absolutely.
I would be an advocate of everything being smaller,
totally.
All competitions being smaller and more elite, and therefore each game is a bigger event, and you can market it better. You can charge more for tickets because people have got fewer chances to go. I mean, you know, I'm no economist, but that's the way I'd structure all rugby tests as well.
When this thing started, obviously things like there were games in Spain, the Catalan team would play there, Perpignan. There were some much, much bigger games. And at the moment, I think this tournament is just slipping down. It used to be overwhelmingly the biggest, bigger than the leagues. Mm. But as soon as they took it from the last game of the season, like a Super Bowl, and took it back inside the league, that was no good. Now the French and the English are justified in saying that actually it can't be justified as the number one above the leagues anymore. And also the problem is, I agree with you both about less is more. But until rugby is run by independent people and a sort of a chief exec running the league who is independent, while it's being run by the clubs, all who have a vote, they're just going to vote for whatever suits them, and they're not going to vote them their way out of a competition. So it's partly rugby administration, but I'm worried about the Champions Cup because it is not remotely as big as it was.
Well, just I'll throw to you on that Cardiff Quins game, but of all the teams who deserve a hat tip that you've mentioned, Steve, I'd throw in Cardiff as well.
They've done admirably well, but lost all their games.
Yeah.
But there's a huge amount of context to that. I mean, again, this is going to become a theme, but another damning stat, I guess, is that the Welsh teams are failing to make the knockout stages for the 10th time in 13 seasons. Mm-hmm. They almost got out of jail because Will Boyd turned over Sam Riley when he went blind and was isolated. But then Willis Alahola drops the ball, Hugh Jones clicks it clear, Priestland shovels a ball to Josh Adams. He's isolated. Dina Lamb turnover. Marcus Smith wins the game with a penalty. So, heartbreaker. But I wonder how different that might have been with fans in the ground.
Yeah, they'd have been jumping, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah. The whole thing about the Anglo-Welsh games, as those of us above the age of 80 remember, is that the hostility was really massive. And Ospreys, incidentally, the biggest and the most invested in club. Blimey, what the heck are they doing? The Toby Booth is a great coach. I mean, they're going to be one of these teams that if you finish real bottom of the division, you don't even get in the Challenge Cup. Mm. And they're going to be one of the embarrassing people. I think you might not even get in the secondary competition, which is just awful.
Banned too for their horrendous khaki kit. They were copying Quinton.
Hang on, there's a few horrendous kits going around.
That game particularly, Racing were playing in red.
Yeah,
and the Ospreys are in sort of weird camo khaki.
Yeah, there's a few other. That Quins kit is. I'm not keen on Bristol. Bristol managed to debut their.
Yeah, their
European
first game.
Kit.
They got their multicoloured kit out.
Yeah, after two cancelled games, they took the field, beat Stade, who were in quite a flashy number as well.
The one I did enjoy actually, and I'm not a massive fan of European kits, and I do find it. We were talking about Bath earlier. They bring out a European kit every year and I don't think they've qualified for the last eight for, what, decades? But no, the Toulouse one was really nice, actually.
Yeah.
The red with the gold. I mean, they're champions. I quite like the fact... I feel like the champion should be allowed to do a European kit with a bit of gold on it for the next season. And they had a huge sleeve thing that said, we have just won the Champions Cup last year, that was quite sort of fun. So they're allowed it, but the other teams are not so sure.
Yeah,
I bet the listeners are really delighted to get your fashion view, you two, as well, honestly. They've been making notes now to make sure they follow up with you, the fashion gurus.
The sleeve branding didn't help them much at the Coventry Building Society Stadium, though, did it, for Toulouse? I mean, that was a hell of a day.
It was a hell of a day, and as I said, we all said, well, there's no way this is going to happen again. Yeah. There's something going on there, which I put to Coach last week, but he denied it. He said that everything that happens in the game is got a technical basis, but I didn't agree with that. There was something there deep in their hearts that was going to take fourth choice players, fifth choice players through against the mighty Toulouse, and some of the stuff they did. Actually, having said that as well, I mean, when you look at, say, the back division, Odogwu was back, but it was still completely recast from the week before. Mm. The fullback was at 10, and Atkinson was at 10, Jacob Umaga was at 15. The way they defended as a back division, considering they'd never played in that formation before, was sensational. People like Elliot Stook, Tom Willis, absolutely magic. B. Yellow, who's had a career in the shadows, really, has just been come out and just blasted it. There is something there which is keeping them going through bad times, bad financial times, huge injuries, that it's doing them wonderfully well. And you have to say, probably not this season, but next season, when they all come back, if they do, Wasps are going to be contenders for the top four and for Europe, because they got something there that you can't bottle, but is doing them wonderfully well.
So, I mean, that's two huge wins in 2 weeks. They beat Leicester in the Premiership the week before, inflicting on Tigers their first defeat of the season. And I was at that game, and afterwards it took Lee Blackett a while to compose his thoughts.
Yeah,
because he said it was a victory on that day founded on emotion.
Yes,
and it did look very similar, Will, on the weekend.
Yeah, I was going to say, this time last week, I had a really good chat with Paolo Odogwu, because we knew he was coming back and returning after 7.5 months out with a knee injury. And we used that interview in Friday's paper, The Times, and he was actually talking about the anti-racism stance that Wasps came up with when people were making decisions on whether they wanted to take the knee. And Wasps as a club decided, as a group, that they wanted to do that to sort of support their BMAE players in their side. And I think the one thing that he touched upon that's pertinent to what they're doing at the moment is he thinks that they're really culturally together in that group. And you can so see it. And I think that someone like Alfie Barbary, as you were talking about, it's not just tactics, that's emotion. And you can see, we had that amazing picture that Mark Asplund took, right place at the right time, of him roaring, looking right down his lens. And you can just see, and it was the same, wasn't it, the Leicester game, where he won that turnover and he was almost looking for someone to celebrate with, wasn't he? Yeah. And you can just kind of see that passion coming through. I love Lee Blackett's dancing. I don't know whether he did another one this week, but the little side shimmy. And he almost apologised for it. And you just think, no, don't. This is great. We want that.
We should probably now bring into the conversation Ed Robinson, skills coach at Wasps, who can tell us from the inside of the camp what it is that drove Wasps to the win against Toulouse and against Leicester, two statement victories for this team.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ed Robinson, thank you for joining us from the Wasp training ground. We were just, before you came on, we were just talking about two momentous wins, but the spirit and the emotion that seemed to underpin both of those victories. Just take us into the squad, in the changing room. What can you put your finger on that sort of emotion that's driven these two victories?
Yeah, every game means everything to us as a group, and there was a lot of hurt from the results that we'd had through the middle part of the season. And there was some unbelievable challenges for us to come up against, obviously against Leicester as the top of the league unbeaten, and against Toulouse, who were the champions of Europe. Couple that kind of emotion of wanting to prove a point, we've been underperforming, so actually show everybody what we're about as a group. Along with a few personal milestones, Thomas Young's 150th game against Leicester, and it's a mark of the group that they wanted to perform for him.
And it's clear on the field who sort of leads that intensity. When you're in camp, when you're preparing for these games, who are the important figures that set that tone that kind of, I guess, trigger those emotions within the players to I guess that leads to the performances that we saw against Leicester, that rear guard action at the end, and of course defeating the European champions.
Well, it all starts from the top. So it starts from the head coach Lee, and it filters down through the coaching staff and through the captain Brad, and actually someone who's really important for the group are the off field guys. So the guys who aren't playing at the moment. So Joan Launchbury has a massive impact on the group. Dan Robson has a massive impact on the group. And then the guys on the field take over when they're on the field. So obviously Brad is massive for that. A guy like Alfie Barbary just brings energy. Guys like Tom Willis just bring energy. They give you everything in every moment. Actually, and particularly in the last game, Bialo brought us a lot of energy, and a massive try-saving tackle at the end of the Leicester game. And that you just find energy from everywhere, and there's a lot of guys. We're lucky; we've got a lot of guys within the group who will bring energy.
When you, I'm just talking about injuries and your role. If there are 19, 20 players injured, which you have at some stages, does that mean that you yourself, in your personal dealings with individuals, have to fast track them if they're suddenly in the first team?
Yeah, I think we're preparing everybody to be ready to step into that role, and. The way the world works, the way the game works, you don't know when your opportunity is going to come, and you just got to be ready for it. And that would tend to be how we prepare everybody anyway, because everything at WASP is about getting better as an individual and as a team. So we're always looking at ways to help players to get better, and then to be ready when their chance comes. But yeah, it doesn't change too much because we know what the game's like, and we know that your opportunity can come at any moment. But obviously, it has been heightened with the situation that we've been in.
The youngsters that we see out there, you know, that scrum half, fly half, and then Jacob played fullback this week, and there's a couple of obviously front rowers, etc. You as a coach must be delighted with the way that they've responded when they've got out there in these big games. The people that not so well known as the likes of Joe Launchbury, etc.
Yeah, that's it. Particularly Charlie Atkinson. I think he's been outstanding in the last two games, playing fly half as a young fly half. And he's been tasked with some pretty tough situations to go up against George Ford, against Leicester, and then to deal with a red card in the second game. And he just deals with that. He just takes it all in his stride. We did a lot of work with him when he was... when he was injured, around managing games and how he can add something to his game. And every project that I set him, he just dived headfirst into it. And it's testament to his work that he's been able to handle it, like you said.
Hi, Ed, it's Will here. Hope you're well. One I wanted to ask you about was Alfie Barbary, who seems to be your kind of all-action hero, especially in the last couple of weeks. Can you give us a bit of insight about what he's like? He seems such a bundle of fun and energy around the place.
Yeah, no, he is. He's an individual character, and he's an important member of the group. He's someone who, as soon as he steps over the line, will give you everything he's got. And sometimes we've got to manage him to make sure he's giving everything in the game for us. Because what we want is guys who will give everything. So every moment they're on the field, doesn't matter what kind of session it is, they're going to give everything, and he's one of those guys.
There was one thing that Lee Blackett told us, I think before Christmas, where he said, Alfie's the sort of guy that if he's losing at Monopoly, he'll flip the board open. Do you think that competitive spirit is what's driving him over the last few weeks? I mean, we saw that Leicester one where he was roaring and celebrating having won that turnover, and then the try this weekend against Toulouse where he's punching the air too.
Yeah, well, it's easy to do in those moments when you score, isn't it? Yeah, no, definitely. He, like, that competitiveness, and we try and drive the competitiveness through training. Almost everything we do is scored, and there's meaning to things, and there's consequences similar to what you find in the game. And we're trying to drive that spirit within the group. I think looking at Leicester, they are a group who have that through every single member of the squad. And what they're able to do week on week is to dig out performances and results like they've done. And what we're finding now is we've been able to do that in the last 2 weeks. And we've got to make sure through guys like Alfie and through their spirit that we continue this momentum that we've built.
How do you back it up then? I mean, it's the backs-to-the-wall hat-trick it could be with Munster coming next. How are you going to raise yourself again for that one to try and make it into a good seeding for the last 16?
So I think it's all in how we plan our preparation. After the Leicester game, Lee had a great idea of letting the guys refresh mentally because it was such a tactical battle as well as a physical battle. And so what we did after the Leicester game is we let the guys refresh mentally, and we kept them in for a very short period of time. We got the work that we needed to do done. We asked them to get to a certain level of intensity when we train. But then as soon as that finished, we let the guys recover. And we were able to back up that performance against Toulouse. And like you say, so the challenges just keep coming away at Munster. And so we're going to approach this week slightly differently. We're lucky that we get an extra day's rest. So we've got a slight tweak to the schedule to make sure we're physically and mentally prepared to have extraordinary effort again.
Thanks, Ed Robinson, for joining us on the Ruck with a fascinating insight into life at Wasps on over two big weekends. Now, coming up next on the Ruck, Jess Hayden will give us all the latest from the Allianz Premier 15s. The three of us here will discuss who might or should be in Eddie Jones' England squad, and we'll have our God or Goddess of the Week feature.
In the Premier 15s, Saracens beat Loughborough Lightning 27-12 to regain their place at the top of the Premier 15s table with a two-point lead on Bristol Bears. The Bears momentarily held the top spot after beating DMP Durham Sharks 48-7 before Saracens overtook them. I mentioned in the last episode of The Ruck that the DMP Durham Sharks were struggling to compete in this league, having lost 104-0 to Saracens in the previous round. In the last week, the RFU have stepped in to help DMP improve their performance, and while 48-7 isn't a scoreline most clubs would celebrate, the last time these sides played, Bristol won 115-0, so perhaps it's a small step in the right direction for DMP. Elsewhere, Gloucester Hartbury beat Sale Sharks 17-3 to stay strong in fifth place and keep up the pressure on the top four. Wasps travelled to Worcester and were ready to play at Sixways Stadium when the match was suddenly called off because the matchday ambulance had not arrived. Worcester released a statement to say they had explored all avenues before agreeing to postpone the fixture. The best was saved until last this weekend with Harlequins versus Exeter Chiefs. Reigning champions Harlequins led for most of the game before Exeter took the lead with the final kick of the game. With Quins ahead 17-15 and the clock red, Exeter's Patricia Garcia kicked a penalty to secure the narrow victory. So the scores from round 11 are Loughborough Lightning 12, Saracens 27, Gloucester Hartbury 17, Sale Sharks 3, DMP Durham Sharks 7, Bristol Bears 48, and finally Exeter Chiefs 18, Harlequins 17.
So the Six Nations is looming. This week Eddie Jones will name his squad, his England squad. Now, as we record, we think it'll be in a number in the 30s. We think it'll probably be pitched for the first game or maybe the first two games against Scotland and Italy. We had Ed Robinson on earlier, as you heard. Alfie Barbary's a name on everyone's lips at the moment. Surely, Will, Steve, Alfie will now get back into that squad, which he has been in before injury intervened.
He's got to be in there, hasn't he? And if he does, it's going to be fascinating how they unleash him and when. Eddie Jones has always been fairly keen to dampen the hype around young players, hasn't he? Maro Itoje, he waited longer than us in the press might have wanted. And same with Marcus Smith. He waited a very long time until he got him in pretty much only for the first time last summer, didn't he? But Alfie Barber, if you look at the back row, and you could have Courtney Laws, Tom Curry, Sam Underhill, Alfie Barbary, Alex Dombrandt, that's a hell of a dynamic set Sam of Simmons. Back rowers. Sam Simmons hasn't even been mentioned. Lewis Ludlam. I mean, that's pretty tasty, isn't it?
What I like about Barbary, and I think one of the reasons that Eddie remains uncertain at the moment about Alex Dombrandt and Sam Simmons is that they are very dynamic in the loose. Barbary will meet you metres where there are no metres to be gained. Like, he will shrug people off, carry defenders with him, get his team going forward through traffic. And I think Eddie Jones, well, I know because he's talked about it, Eddie Jones prizes that quality enormously for his back row players, particularly if he's looking at a number eight.
It's the balance, isn't it? He tried Courtney Laws at six pretty successfully in the autumn tests. And you just wonder if Tom Curry's back at seven, which I personally think and lots of us think is his best position, then what do you want your eight
position
to be?
Yeah. It's his only position.
So then a Barbary character at eight with a Simmons or a Dombrandt off the bench or the other way round, I mean, that is really strong.
You've got, and there's an embarrassment of riches now for England. Steve, you will have reported on England teams for a long time, sort of post 03, where they were scratching around for back row options. And now, you know, Will's naming a list there, which he didn't initially include Sam Simmons, wouldn't include Ben Earl, who a year ago was seen as that classic bench, versatile, dynamic, skillful back row player who now hasn't featured this year for England. This season for England.
Well, look, you're right, but we're talking here about perceived wisdom and what we may have heard and what we think should happen. That never applies when Eddie's picking a team. It'll be the usual Disney enterprises with Mr. M. Mouse and Mr. D. Duck figuring prominently in the squad rather than people who deserve it. What the whispers I've heard make me aghast that yet again he doesn't twig that the English public, and I speak from many years of experience, love the Grand Slam. Suddenly the sponsors love it. People don't mind paying £200 to go in there. There are reverberations through every town and county, city, hamlet and churchyard. And that never happens. What you say about the back rowers is I totally agree with, but that's who we three might pick. It doesn't mean Eddie will pick him. I mean, to be honest, frankly, I'd be frank. Going to Barbary and saying you are a back row forward, that is completely scandalous. But Barbary is a young man; he's not yet developed. Maybe Bath are going to be short of a hooker and they want him there because he's definitely got the build of a hooker. And these days, hookers play like front flankers at the front of a lineout. So, look, we're talking, or you two guys are talking sense here. Sense goes out the window when Eddie Jones picks an England team.
Just on that note, and to put a bit more meat on the bone of the Disney characters that Steve mentioned, I might not go that far, but the word is that, well, we're probably going to get a few classic Eddie-type picks where the unexpected guys that us lot who write about rugby a lot have probably not seen much of them play. And it's no disrespect to any of the guys' picks, but it's always the case, isn't it, where we get two or three characters who no one would have written before who are in the squad. I mean, a few names that I might chuck in that are possibly doing the rounds. Will Goodrick Clark from London Irish is a big loose head who might get a call up. Guys like Ollie Hassel-Collins, who's been in the squad before. I mean, another area where England have got an absolute plethora of options. And he's been in brilliant try-scoring form. But when you've got the likes of Jack Noel possibly coming back in, Adam Radwan, Johnny May, I mean, Anthony Watson's currently injured. You've got Stewart, Malins, Marchant, Northmore might be a new pick as well. And then another one doing the rounds, Orlando Bailey could well get a shout too. I mean, he's a young guy on the rise, but I think I know what Steve might think of picking a young guy possibly before he's so achieved lots at club level.
What we're saying here is that the accent, we think the accent on an England squad for this Six Nations will be still on uncovering new talent. What we're saying here is that it doesn't feel like that the Makos and the Billies and the George Fords are in the mix. And Steve, you're saying what I agree with. In fact, I think we underplay the Grand Slam in the sense that that should be everything. We've allowed the narrative to develop that England are happy winning Six Nations titles.
Yes,
that there didn't used to be. It used to be the Grand Slam or nothing really.
It was the Grand Slam, I think. And you know, if people, I've seen Wales at Twickenham take the championship trophy. I think it was Ian Evans, having lost at Twickenham, which was bad enough. But they were still champions, and they absolutely hated it because the Grand Slam was everything. Now, you can say, look, it's only Italy, Scotland, but actually, Italy are awful. Scotland are improving. Ireland are hellish difficult. France could have a great season, and Wales will definitely improve on their autumn because they always do. The Grand Slam is worth winning. Now, Woodward didn't win it for a long time because he kept on losing the last game by a single point. It is difficult. It's hellishly difficult to win, and it is worth winning. And then you get people behind them. Eddie Jones keeps on saying, oh, you press, you're after me, you're after me, you want to get rid of me. If you won every game, Eddie, no one would do anything but lay and strew palm trees in front of your feet.
Isn't this squad an example of where life is difficult for an England coach, in the sense that we've
too many options?
We've looked at that back row. There are international standard players everywhere. Look at fly half. You've got, you know, any country in the world would want either of those two players, one of whom, George Ford, may well not be in the squad at all. You could look second row, you could look front row, where England have got some issues in terms of depth, particularly at tight head, we think, but they've got more options than anyone else. Steve, does that make life harder in some ways? Like in Wales, if you've got one player, you're picking that player and you stick with him, and he's won 50 caps before he's 23, 24, and he is your man. England, is there a temptation? Are there too many options? Does that make life harder in some ways?
I refuse to feel sorry for England because they've got a lot of choice of players. Don't forget...
Well, I'm not saying you feel sorry for them, but it's a different challenge.
Ronan O'Gara, the great Ronan O'Gara, had loads and loads of terrible games for Ireland in the first of his career. I thought he was awful. But because they didn't have anyone else, they kept on picking him. Eventually, he became fantastic. That can be advantageous sometimes. And New Zealand haven't got that much, whatever they think, they haven't got that much depth. England have got depth. But when we get these notes every day that five coaches are going to watch rugby matches live, then they're going to watch them on video. So everyone, then they speak to their coaches, then they speak to the players. Everyone has got all the information they need to pick the best side, or at least the best combination. Sam Simmons might not go with certain flankers. Ditto Alex Donbrand. I think Alex Donbrand is a good player. I can see why they'd pick him. I can also see why they wouldn't pick him. But that is why they're there. That's why they're international selectors, to find it. You know, I mean, it's a bit easier with cricket because you just look at the runs they score or haven't scored.
Or don't score.
Or don't score.
If you scored 10 now, for England, for the next 10 years. But I don't think so. And I think that the people like Woody and Andy Robinson, now Andy Robinson wasn't a great head coach of England. He was a brilliant coach, teamed up brilliantly with Clive Woodward. They knew what the team was. And if you remember, their world championship team, only one player came in the 18 months before the tournament. That was Josh Lucy. No one else did. And that, if he's really aiming at the world team now, that's what they should be doing. It is up to him to sort it out and not have selection by scattergun.
So, Ruck listeners won't have met me before, but I have a quite obsessive and tragic streak in me. And I've, over the Eddie Jones's tenure as England coach...
Don't bring up the red trousers now, for God's sake.
No, this is not the trousers. This is my Excel spreadsheet that has documented every player that Eddie Jones has picked over his tenure since 2016. And we shall see. But this week we might get to the double top 180 of players that he's picked. We're about 174 at the moment. So he usually chucks in about six or seven uncapped players. That is a hell of a lot of players. It's something like 30 back rowers that have come in, and whether that's a Barbar squad that's slightly different or when the lines are away. And I think you're right. I mean, I covered in my previous role Wales a lot, and they pick the same guys largely for a decade, pretty much. Mm. The sort of George North, Lee Halfpenny, Alan Wynne-Jones guys. And there is time, I think, there, because the pool is smaller, to have a few bad years and you're still in contention because you are an elite player. Whereas with England, that we've seen hundreds of characters come, win five caps and then be discarded. You mentioned Ben Earl earlier. Mm. Ollie Lawrence is another one. Alex Lazowski. I mean, that 2018 game against Japan was the sort of end of a thousand careers, wasn't it? With Danny Kerr getting discarded and Jack Noel playing centre and Owen Farrell having to kind of rescue it off the bench, didn't he?
Okay, so England start their Six Nations away in Scotland. Let's whiz through a sort of a depth chart per position. Will, you were talking before we came on air on the tight head situation.
Mm.
What's your pecking order there?
Well, I think there is only two real sort of established options. And I'm worried on England's behalf that it might become his 2023 scrum half, whereas in 2019, Ben Spencer's flying out the eve before the World Cup final and with no caps pretty much because they haven't had anyone else in camp. So Carl Sinclair, clearly the number one choice, and Will Stewart has been the number two choice. But after that, what else have they got? They've got plenty of options, but not many have had a cap.
Joe Hayes.
Paul Hill, guys like that.
Dan Cole come back.
Yeah, well, but it doesn't look likely. But, I mean, that could be a problem area.
Steve Hooker?
Jamie George, first, last and always. Unbelievable competitor. It was a gross insult to him to say you're being dropped because we want to test your mettle. That was absolutely disgraceful.
And behind him, Cowan Dickey?
Cowan Dickey, yes.
And then
B. Yallo is a backup tight head prop, clearly.
Loose head is Genjan and Marler.
Joe Marler.
I'd have Marler start, especially starting, in Scotland, I would say.
Genj off the bench.
I got a huge question mark about Genj as an international rugby player.
Which is technical?
Temperament and technical. Mm. And it's shared by a lot of premiership coaches as terms of scrummaging.
Second row, I think we're probably mostly
agreed. Itoji plus one, isn't it?
Itoji plus
Hill, probably.
Itoji plus Hill. I think Hill's playing out of his skin. Hill played brilliantly in defeat at Harlequins the other day.
Might be interesting a year from now when George Cruz is back.
Mm.
Yeah. I suspect it might be Itoji plus Cruz by then.
The other one is interesting too, and I'm not sure whether he'll be in the squad or not, but Joe Launchbury's coming back very soon. Mm. He needs a game, clearly. But he's a bit of an Eddie favourite. And is a clearly international class rugby player, 60 odd caps.
If you play Joe, you've got to play a jumper in your back row, though. It changes the balance.
Yeah,
yeah.
And there are loads of players. Nick Izyekwi is another example of those Lazowski, Penel school who just fell on the wrong side of an opinion and haven't been seen.
Yeah.
Since back row, we've looked at, but if you name three to start against Scotland, Steve?
Curry, Billy, Courtney.
Will?
I would go for Laws at six, Curry at seven, and then Dombrandt eight with a Barbary bench.
Yeah, I think I'd stick with Underhill and Curry against Scotland with Courtney at six because they're the breakdown.
So Curry at eight then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Breakdown. I'm unconvinced by him as an eight, for sure, but I think the value of having Curry and Underhill against Scotland and their turnover kings is enormous, and you've got to play Courtney.
Against Watson and Ritchie.
As my mother used to say, reference your selection of Curry, there's no point in having a dog and buying a dog and barking yourself, and that's what you're doing if you've got a great open side flanker.
It's going to be Youngs. You think Randall and Quirk as the three, which Mitchell starts.
If you want your wonder boy at 10, I'd have Kerr at 9.
I mean, I would have Kerr there too, but he's just not going to get picked. So I think that's a bit of a moot point.
Randall's the closest.
Yeah. Like Randall, yeah.
Okay, so I'm picking Smith at 10. Will's going to pick
Smith at 10.
10.
Yeah.
Steve, and you're picking.
There's a third choice just come in from Gregor Townsend. if fit, George Ford definitely. If fit, Farrell.
Yeah, so Farrell's an interesting one because he is due to make his comeback from injury on Saturday against London Irish, Sunday against London Irish in the Challenge Cup. Wow. He hasn't played since he was injured in the Australia game in November.
Right.
We're back exactly where we were pre-last Six Nations with Owen Farrell having not played any rugby.
Right.
The squad will be named before he makes his comeback. I he'll probably be in it, but it wouldn't be a surprise if he wasn't in it on the just on the basis that it's an initial squad.
Right.
If he's there, I suspect he'll be involved. I think he'll play 12 if he's there.
I'd personally be amazed if he doesn't start every game he's available
no,
for.
No, what you can't do is play him 12. If you want to play your wonder boy, you can't play Smith and Farrell at 10 and 12 in the modern era, especially against Jonathan Dante. My choice, definitely.
He doesn't play for Scotland, though.
No, or France. My choice, well before he was anywhere near the England team, because I've been banging his drum for 5 years, is Mark Atkinson. He's got power and he can play rugby. And just because he didn't come up through the old desperate schools scholarship and then the under sixes, the under tens, the under 20s, just because he didn't do that, they don't rate him. He's a really good player.
You're
going to need his strength in the centre.
He could be a bit of an Esterhazen figure for England, who's someone who can kick off both feet, pass well, comes to the line, pulls the ball back for someone coming round the corner, can carry hard too. He's
brilliant,
a good option.
Character. Brilliant. Bring absolutely everything to that camp.
You can have Smith, Farrell 10, 12.
Even if you've got Manu at 13, which is
but that's different. That's what I said in the paper on Sunday. If Manu's there, the whole thing changes. But he isn't there.
Which is why I've repeatedly said he's the most important player for England, because if he's there, they can play what they want. If he's not there, everything becomes...
That's what I said in column 46 of the Sunday Times yesterday.
Didn't quite get that far.
Isn't it fascinating, though? We're in 2022.
Still talking.
And we're still talking about where's Owen Farrell's best position 10 years on. And we're still talking about Manu changes England's backline 10, 11 years on.
Yep.
It's the same problems every single year.
Yep.
Or not necessarily problems, but conundrums.
And I think and one of the interesting things between now and the World Cup in terms of England selections is how malleable it all becomes. So the big kind of standout selection in the autumn was Manu picked on the wing in jersey number. He didn't actually play on the wing. What actually happened was that Henry Slade played fullback.
Yeah.
And then we had Joe Marchant playing on the wing, a centre playing on the wing.
Mm.
So Freddie Stewart played on the wing a bit. Max Malins in the summer was picked on the wing because Eddie likes a fullback who
did his shoulder, got injured.
Did his shoulder. Yeah. I think we're going to see a lot of that kind of movement, which is why Jack Noll coming back would fit that template perfectly, because he can pop up anywhere and be effective.
Noll was our Saturday interview, and I think it was heartening what he was saying, because as we wrote in the interview, that after a couple of years out, people kind of get forgotten a bit, don't they? But it sounds like he's been in quite constant contact with
Eddie.
Eddie
speaks to me all the time.
And I think that's good. And
I said that he speaks to me all the time as well.
And I think he could be a bit of like we're talking about with Esterhazen figure in Atkinson, he could kind of be the Caden Murley type figure that Quinns have got with Smith, who's coming off his wing, bustling through contact, sometimes an auxiliary flanker. He's strong, got big legs, hasn't he? And it can be that cross-field kick option as well for Smith that he uses so well.
Jack, we got fullback Stewart has been playing superbly. I don't want to create question marks where there aren't any, but they have got to make sure that Malins is in that squad somewhere, because he's a superlative player. And I don't have him much below Stewart as a fullback either.
May's a fascinating one as well. He absolutely gives everything for England and has been a star for quite a long time now. But he, when it goes to club form, he hasn't been pulling up loads of trees, has he, really, for Gloucester?
He's been very quiet for England last year, Jack. That's why he didn't go on the Lions tour.
But he's probably, again, he's an Eddie favourite. He's one of the leadership guys, isn't he? He drives a bit of standards and stuff like that in camp, so you'd suspect he would be in.
Look, so Alex, it's a leadership figure on the ruck, but we never listen
driving
to him.
Standards. We're doing our extras after this.
But again, it just goes back to the point, the number of options. You know, Anthony Watson's injured, and England could still field a back three that would strike fear into teams because you've got a Malins and a Stewart and a May if he's firing, or a Jack Noll who I just think he brings everything.
So I think if Radwan is as quick as they say is, he's got to have a chance. He's got to have a chance.
Eddie likes having a quick winger and a work rate winger. So it's May or Radwan, and then a Noel or Malins kind of figure,
enough,
isn't it?
Fair enough.
With Stewart at fullback.
Yeah, well, I think Malins has gas that could make him a legit kind of...
And he's a great finisher. I mean, four tries before Christmas with Sarries. He was, what, 7 in 2 games or something like that, wasn't it? He's clearly got some talent, hasn't he?
So there you go. There's the first selection debate of the Six Nations that will carry on for about the next couple of months and then beyond. And to round off Will Keller's debut pod, we'll go to our God or Goddess of the Week feature. Although Mark Evans's input has now opened up a whole new category of Devil of the Week, although maybe that will only go to the Montpellier selectors. Steve, I think I know who you're going to pick.
I think, look, I don't often go 2 in 2 weeks, but for what he typifies in 2 great games, I am returning to B.E. Allo, the Wasps tight head prop.
I think that's
tremendous on the weekend. I've never had the same bloke twice.
I'm not sure anyone has been nominated 2 weeks in a row.
No, he's back up there. He's up there, the God of the Week. I'm sorry, I mean it.
Steve, on Big B.E., how across Spotify are you?
B.E.?
Yeah, no, Spotify. He's an artist. He's a singer.
I know that.
He's a musician. You need to get down to his underground raves.
I do get down to his underground raves. What, you mean on the bottom floor?
Yeah, the basement,
Yeah, right. No, I didn't know that, but I look him up.
So he's good at other things too, not just crashing and bashing in the front row.
Right.
If it was me, I'm going Wasps as well, actually. We could get a Wasps hat-trick, but I was going to go away from the actual team itself and just give my first one to Lee Blackett.
Yeah. Good one.
I think... to bring what he's brought out of that side with so many injuries. I mean, we're getting lists every week at the bottom of the team sheet saying players unavailable, and they're 15 to 20 lads. And to beat the champions of Europe and the unbeaten Premiership winners in 2 weeks, wonder if he can do a hat-trick. Pretty special, that.
Yeah. Well, it is going to be a Wasps hat-trick on this nominations panel because we can't have talked up Alfie Barbary the way we have without somebody... putting his name forward. So yeah, it's Wasps 1-2-3 I think on our God of the Week nominations. Everyone, thanks for joining us. Thanks Ed Robinson for coming on. We'll be back next week to talk Europe and look into the Six Nations.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.